Premium Hoops presents Sense and Scalability.
Sense and Scalability. Welcome back, you NBA heads. We're talking ball. We're talking defense. We have Seth Partnow on the episode. How you doing, Seth?
I'm doing okay. You know, anyone who's ever played basketball with me wonders what the hell I'm doing on a podcast talking about defense, but here we are.
Yeah, and we'll get to why, you know, what led to Seth coming on the podcast in a moment. But before we do that, I got to make the rounds. How you doing, Evan?
Doing great, Scott. I appreciate that we've fallen into a very traditional order where you ask me first and ask Cody. It's nice to have tradition sometimes. But yeah, we have a really cool topic today. We kind of fell into this one ass backwards a little bit. I think it's going to be a lot of fun to discuss. And obviously, as Scott mentioned, we'll kind of tell the story of how we fell into this one shortly. But yeah, doing great.
Cody!
That was a lot. I'm doing great today. I'm getting a little nervous, though, because this is my second defense pod of the week, and I have a couple articles about defense this year, and I'm afraid I'm going to start getting typecast, and those are the only roles Hollywood will give out to me. So I got to start breaking out of my defense. But for right now, I'm locked and loaded heavily in my defense position, so I'm ready for this.
I actually am fresh off listening to you and Mark's podcast on defense for Premium Hoops. But I won't judge you if you reuse anything you said there, because as people who listen to every episode know, I'm a big fan of reusing ideas. But we have a new idea that came, as Evan said, kind of spontaneously when Seth was texting Evan about, you know, a few things that he maybe, let's say, took exception to in our last podcast. Seth, I'll just let you get into it because, you know, I can't replicate your experience listening to Sense and Scalability. And I kind of want to know what your process was in reaching out to Evan about what we might have overlooked.
Evan's not the first person to experience this, where oftentimes when I'm listening to a podcast, it becomes sort of a I don't want to call it a live blog, more of a live text harangue of everything I disagree with as I'm hearing it. So I'll like listen to like pause it. It's like, what? No, what? Come on. And so that was sort of that was the process that we were going through. I don't remember what day that was. It was last Friday where I was listening to the defense pod, the juice pod, and was just kind of, you know, taking exception, but disagreeing, respectfully but vehemently with some of the points being made.
Yes, and specifically I remember I listened back to it today because I wanted to remember what those points were in the first place, and I kind of had a line about how Gobert with the Jazz, they were forced to just stick him on Terrence Mann and had no counter if Mann got burned. And I think I meant that I said it in a way that kind of really reflected poorly on Gobert, in the sense that, like, oh, if he has to guard a shooter, what the fuck does he do? Which I don't think is the full thing, because, you know, that's kind of underscoring Jazz's lack of point of attack defense, which is the reason he had to kind of hover between man and the rim in the first place. And obviously, you know, that wasn't that catastrophic as that game. That was a situation where everything was clicking for the Clippers offense. It kind of will be the landmark game for any, you know, Gobert skeptics, I think, for, you know, this offseason and months to come. So really looking forward to that one. Yay. But is that kind of when you started texting Evan?
Yeah, because I think that sort of point, you were talking about sort of modes of building a good offense, and I think sort of ignoring some of the situation where, yeah, the Clippers had a lot of people who could create offense, whether as a primary or a secondary against Utah, because Utah didn't have anybody who could contain the ball with Mike Conley hobbled. So yeah, it is easy to create offense from multiple spots on the floor if there's nobody who can, you know, what's the first precept of defense is stop the ball. If nobody can stop the ball, then the scheme almost doesn't matter. And you're bailing water and hoping that the ship doesn't completely sink. And so, you know, Gobert's having to sprint to the rim and sprint to the corner and whatever. And it's sort of a, one of the reasons why defense is so hard to evaluate is you don't just take like the negative box score. You don't say, well, he was guarding this guy and this guy scored X, therefore he was bad at defense, because especially for kind of support players and off ball shooters, I don't want to say it's rarely, but it is not at all always that the person who is, quote, guarding that player is responsible for them getting a shot. I would go so far as to say it's usually not. And so that's a, you know, Terrence Mann scored whatever he scored in that game on Rudy Gobert, but he's not getting those looks. He's not getting to attack those closeouts. He's not getting those threes if Reggie Jackson isn't just straight line driving off of one move every trip down the floor. And so that's not a scheme issue. That's a talent and execution issue. And you know, no scheme works if you don't have the guys who can play it or play it poorly, and drawing conclusions about scheme from visibly poor execution and under talent is, you know, can lead you some bad spots. And it you know, in some ways that actually reflects why the Jazz got themselves in the trouble they got into, is they can get away with sort of system defense against the Clevelands of the world. And you know, even in a regular season setting against a pretty good team, like Gobert can cover up enough. But then you get into a playoff situation and all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, we can get Bojan Bogdanović switched onto our point guard. Let's go. And then everything breaks down because there's no all of that scheme and angles and everything like that Utah has relied on all season is suddenly out the window just because you're cracking their first defensive shell so easily by, you know, picking out those matchups you know you can just beat.
And I appreciated your initial pushback too, because as somebody who has watched every game of the Chicago Bulls experience for like the last 4 years, especially since the Bulls have transitioned more towards drop, I have been a vehement defender of Wendell Carter Jr., of even Nikola Vucevic, in drop coverage. And the reason was that the point of attack defense was so poor that there's no predictability behind that first level of shell breaking, right? It's very hard to judge performance in a defensive context that is consistently broken. And when you're losing at point of attack like that so consistently, that's going to create a real problem no matter who's behind it. Now, I do think we did a pretty good job we definitely misappropriated the blame, I think, in kind of discussing Gobert's involvement in the problem more than the point of attack defense. But I do think we underscored some issues with, one, like you mentioned, the struggle of creating a team that relies so heavily on one look in the regular season. But two, like, I think from a roster building perspective and from an opportunity cost perspective, I think we brought up some good points about how difficult it is to build a versatile defense that is playoff tested and playoff ready when you appropriate so much of your resources, like especially in the cap, to a one-way defensive center. So Gobert is elite at what he does, but you do have, I feel like, less to build with around that in terms of creating other defensive looks.
I still would want to push back on that, because the issue that Utah has gotten into isn't that they only have one defensive look, it's they have only one defensive player. Because he's so good in a regular season setting that you can have Joe Ingles and Bojan Bogdanović as your 3 and 4 and still have a really good defense, because, you know, in a regular season setting, having those guys be smart and Rudy Gobert be Rudy Gobert is good enough to have to create a top five, top 10 defense. And then in the playoffs, you know, the schematic and talent issues make those guys much more of a liability, those at the 3 and 4. as they are in the regular season. And that's not a Gobert issue. That's not even necessarily a investment of resources issue. It's just everything else they've spent money on has been offensive players who, you know, for the most part can be smart positional defenders, but even Royce O'Neal, who's a pretty good defender, if he's guarding the other team's best creator because he has to, is fairly substantially overmatched. So if you're saying that because of the security blanket of Gobert, they have allocated other resources in a non-playoff optimal way, yeah, that might be true. But who is that? Like, you're saying he's too good at being good in the regular season so that they make other mistakes. And that's, if he was less good of a regular season defender, they'd be better because they wouldn't make those mistakes. That might be true, but like, where are we putting the blame if that's that's what's going on?
And I kind of had that moment with the Bucks. Now, it's kind of, I don't want to say anything definitive on them, because even before Giannis hyperextended his knee, they would either make me look smart or make me look dumb, or usually make me look dumb as soon as I opened my mouth about the Bucks. But my thing for a while when they were looking kind of dead against the Nets was, maybe, you know, they should have, and this is getting awkward because I realize you worked for the Bucks, Seth, but
no, it was, you know, it was a long ago enough that like, okay, the adjustments that like I, you know, the players who were acquired on this roster, Brook Lopez is probably the one that, you know, was most, you know, in the rest of it, like Middleton and Giannis were there before I got there. And,
right,
you know, and PJ Tucker and Drew Holiday were after, and yeah, and Dante DiVincenzo was there when we drafted him, but that's, yeah, like, he didn't become a frontline player until like after I was gone. So, you know,
all right,
I don't feel attacked.
Okay. Well, I guess it kind of reminds me of like what you're saying Gobert did, like just by keeping it afloat. I felt like Giannis kind of did to an extent with the Bucks offense. You also had Middleton. And meanwhile, I think you're saying, you know, is it Gobert's fault that he did so well in the regular season and you saw things you didn't see in the playoffs? That reminds me of, it just reminded me of how I thought about the Bucks, where it's like, I don't blame Giannis for not having more dimensions. I blame him, you know, maybe those around him not taking some of his regular season production with a grain of salt, but that's neither here nor there. And you can comment on that if you'd like to, but what I'd say about Gobert is like, in that case, it is kind of not less his fault. The blame might go more, and I know this is easy to do, but the blame might go more on like, not even blame, but like, you know, maybe that's on the management for not realizing that wouldn't work as well in the playoffs. Maybe they didn't have a choice, so it's hard to blame them, but I guess if it had to go somewhere, that's my, yeah, where and, it might, yeah, go.
And maybe if Mike Conley and Donovan Mitchell are healthy in the playoffs, that they score well enough that this is a non-issue.
Yeah, so you're right. That's a good point.
That was, so the larger point I kind of wanted to get to is that about your, you know, you guys are I appreciate the way you guys are kind of developing and revising theories. It is a little worrisome to over-index or to index so heavily on the results when there's, you know, especially this year, when there's just so many kind of sliding doors moments about what is happening out there. Like who ends up actually winning these series is based, you know, there's much more parity among the top 6 to 10 teams than there has been probably in the last decade. Is that fair to say? Mm-hmm. Like since
definitely
since the Heatles like got together basically. So like the, you know, the outcome of a 60-40 coin flip, I don't think is enough to completely reorganize your one's thinking about what works and what doesn't in the playoffs. And I don't think it shouldn't, like, I'm not saying throw everything out, but there is, you know, I do see, and you guys are hardly the only and hardly the worst offenders of this, is like, well, this proves that you can't do it that way and you can only do it this way, and mm-hmm. that doesn't work. And it's just like, yeah, they make two more jump shots. Kevin Durant likes his toes are an inch and a half shorter, and then maybe you can go all in on offense and still win the title. You know what I mean? Even with, you know, your other two stars getting hurt. So I get antsy about, you know, just so stories, if you will.
No, that's totally true. I kind of felt in that like mindset going into last podcast, but it's really good to hear that. Like, I definitely extrapolate a lot.
Scott, if I recall correctly, I believe that you said at the start of last episode, or maybe it was at the end of last episode.
It was at the beginning.
That we reserve the right to change any of our opinions on any of this, because we came into, especially I think we came into the last episode pretty hot. It was more like a, could this be something? But we didn't always deliver it in that way. And I think it's a helpful reminder, right? Like, we've said it before in this podcast, especially earlier in the season, but like, this is a weird season. It's off the back of a shortened off season. It's on the front of another shortened off season. And, you know, there's Olympic considerations. The playoff format was weird last year, and there's been a lot of travel and a heavy, dense schedule. So there's a lot going on. I think we've seen, and I haven't obviously done the math on this, but we've seen probably more injuries to star players this year than at least in the last 5 years, if I had to guess. So I think it's a good reminder, like, that there is a grain of salt that should be applied when we consider any high scale schematic conclusions about what does and doesn't work. Because like you said, like, the margins can be so fine. And we might have even referenced, I think, the Kevin Durant foot on the line for the three pointer, because I think he even wears like a size shoe that is one above his usual. So the margins are about as fine as it gets in any sport. And it's a helpful reminder both to us as analysts and to the people who listen to this podcast that, you know, it's important to keep in mind those longer standing trends.
And an additional kind of funniness is that I think you guys would agree with me in saying that playoff basketball and regular season basketball are diverging kind of more than ever from us, like, a strategic standpoint. Now that's happening. And at the same time, like, this year, that may even be overemphasized because the bulk of this season was played in a different environment than the playoffs. You don't want to, you know, ascribe it completely to fans, but between the bubble and most of this season, I think we have reasonably good evidence that, like, the fanless environment is a slightly better shooting environment. And, you know, it's a subtle difference, but when we're talking about, like, the math of the trade-offs of a drop defense versus a switching defense versus whatever, like, a point and a half in like open 3-point percentage is a huge difference in which of those is more optimal. And so is that, then this year, is that like more of a divergence because playoff and regular season, or is that the change from no fans to fans? And I don't think we're going to have a good answer for that until, you know, this point next year.
And quite possibly it's been exacerbated by like the condensed schedule and the shortened off seasons that we were talking about. But I'm almost thinking about regular season games slightly more in the context of like innings eating, depending on, especially as you go deeper down the roster, than I ever have before. And the divergences in the way the game is played, the counters that are performed, and, you know, what's important and how the pace changes in the playoffs are monumental, and they get bigger every year, it seems. So, I mean, they are two totally, almost totally different games to compare at times. And the playoffs, it just continues, that gap continues to grow.
So I want to revise maybe a little bit of what I was saying about point of attack defense, because I still do feel like I'm pretty skeptical of it on a certain level. Like, I think where I'm at right now is that I think there's a certain threshold where all five players need to be at that threshold to have a good point of attack system. But I still think it's somewhat overrated to have one or two players who are excellent, tremendous, all-time point of attack defenders, and everyone else is maybe subpar or, you know, even just hovering around average. And I'm thinking of teams like the 76ers with Ben Simmons and Thybulle being out there, and you're like, oh, you can just sic one of them on one of the guards, on Herter or Trey or whoever else, and it'll be good. But the thing is in the playoffs that I feel like something I've been noticing is that a lot of the offenses have been a lot more complex, right? So if one player is starting on, you know, guarding Trae Young, by the end of the possession, they might not be on Trae Young. You know, there's a lot of double drag type of sets like Chicago or away that are being run. And most of the time after one of those, Ben Simmons is no longer on Trae Young or Ben Simmons is no longer on Kevin Huerter. And so I'm like, is it really that valuable to have a player that's that good at point of attack defense if the offense can just be smart enough to kind of run them around some actions and get them, you know, mess up the assignments that are put out there? And that's kind of where I'm at right now. I'm like, I don't know how valuable it is to be that much better at point of attack versus having everyone just be an average level point of attack defender.
No, I think that's fair. You could say, is playoff defense more of a strongest link or weakest link kind of thing? And I think it, you know, regular season, you probably can lean more into the strongest and in the playoffs because of the ability to target and the willingness to continue targeting. That's more so in the playoffs. Like, yeah. At the same time, I don't think we should go too far with that. Just observationally, yes, for much of the game, teams can be more complex. I do think in close games, we see it over and over. And I don't think there's a good actual reason for it, but it's a psychological thing that just happens. That complexity drops off, you know, as the game goes. And especially like we've seen this, part of the reason the Clippers have had success is their switching has invited, what have you, teams to stop running their cool stuff. You know, friend of everyone's, Nekias Duncan is a big proponent of the Spain pick and roll. And he was asking, you know, in game five, how many Spain pick and rolls did Phoenix run when that's, you know, they wore that play out in other series because, you know, they're getting these switches and they get one switch and get like I've got half an eye on the game going on right now. And Marcus Morris just switched on the campaign. Oh, Marcus Morris switched on the campaign. Well, I'm faster than him. Let's go. Instead of continuing to run that more complex system that can create not just a small gap, but a big gap that, you know, leads to an open three, leads to a duck in for Ayton. And it seems that those, for whatever reason, those complexities just decline as games and series wear on.
Yeah, and I think maybe the way that I think about this best, like one of the reasons why I think switching defense is so alluring, if you can find the players and acquire the players that can play it consistently and reliably, or at least to a certain level, is that allows you to set the terms of engagement, which is kind of what we've been talking about as the battle between offense and defense that ratchets up in the playoffs. And so, you know, we were discussing how defense might be a weakest link situation. I think offense is a strongest link situation where, you know, the strongest offensive player on your team is probably going to be the most important, especially, like you said, as you get into later, closer game situations and teams rely a little bit more on ISO creation. Whereas defense being a weakest link situation, up until those clutch moments, teams are running schematic things to try to set those terms of engagement. What are your thoughts on that? I'm just going to let you in now.
Yeah, no, sorry. I made a face because DeAndre Ayton made a nice move.
A huge relief. I was like, shit, I am blowing it.
No. So this is, there's a broader thing at work here. And we're talking, you know, when we're talking about strongest link, weakest link, the expression that's really popping into my mind is min-maxing. And min-maxing works in the regular season. I don't think it works in the playoffs. I think because you're talking about offense being more about your strongest guy. Yeah, sure. But how many a playoff offense gets completely messed up because the fifth guy is a complete passenger. And now you're, you know, okay, fine. We've got this dominant like point of attack creator, but there's a guy just standing waiting for him in the paint because we don't care about guarding Andre Robertson in the corner. And it's, you know, I'm sorry, but it's always going to be, you know, it's the Andre Robertson corollary. It's like, I don't care if he makes every shot he takes, he doesn't take enough shots for me to want to guard him. And that's a weakest link thing. And that happens on both sides of the ball, where you can't lean completely into any one thing. At this point, like, is there a skill that you can lean completely into and you can rely on it to work in the playoffs? I mean, I maybe if you were the Warriors and you just had that much on ball creation, but we don't have that team now. So there, that ability to react and adjust and do multiple things on both sides of the ball becomes almost more key. And whether that's, you know, having players who are, you know, the Marcus Morris type, who becomes, I think, a more valuable playoff than regular season player because he can do so many different things on both sides of the ball. Or, you know, the Clippers are also sort of lucky in that they have so many different guys that they can try out to do stuff. And, you know, I think some people kind of made fun of the signing when they signed DeMarcus Cousins, but like, they're finding spots where that's a useful club to have in the bag. And there are other teams that, you know, don't have, hey, here's a 11th guy usually we can throw out there to change stuff up. Like, you know, okay, Boban isn't necessarily an 82 game players, but did he win a playoff game for Dallas? I think you could argue he did. So having that roster versatility is important as well.
And I'm glad you brought up the Clippers, because I just wondered how much of Gobert's internet demise was just the Clippers being this unique five out team. And I tried to like construct a way to defend that look that they gave the Jazz in the third quarter with a drop big. And I kind of like, I guess you just have to have a really strong shell. I guess you have to, you know, not rely on Gobert standing under the rim so that, you know, when Joe Ingles inevitably gets blown by. But I'm still not sold that there's like, I don't know if I'm sold or not. That's too hard of a term, but I still don't know exactly what the optimal defense with a drop big looks like against such a unique team as the Clippers that the Jazz kind of unfortunately for them matched up with.
If I may jump in, I actually feel like the best response to that, and I talked about this a little bit with Mark, is to have that drop big be able to punish that team on the other end of the court. Whereas like Rudy Gobert, when you go on offense with the Jazz, you can't dump the ball down to him or have him punish them really in the pick and roll as much. Whereas Ayton, you know, there were a couple times that he was able to slip in with a pick and roll, and Batum's down there, and all he can do is kind of hack him as he seamlessly slides in for a nice little finger roll finish or something like that. So I feel like the offensive end is where you actually have to make them respond to try and counter that Clippers lineup.
I agree and disagree. I agree in concept. I disagree that like the reason why Ayton has been more successful hasn't been that they've dumped the ball into him. It's been that Phoenix has been more successful at, you know, creating a first crease and then, okay, Booker draws just a little bit of help. So Bridges guy comes up off the corner just a little bit. And then the pass goes to Bridges in the corner. He has a baseline drive, and on his baseline drive, Ayton rolls to the top of the circle, catches it and finishes. There was none of Utah had zero of that. And so it's like, yeah, like Rudy, you're not going to just throw the ball to Rudy, like have him stick his foot in the ground, stick his hand up and go to work. You're not going to do that because there's two guys in the NBA who that's a good offense for right now. Am I missing anyone besides Embiid and Jokic for whom that's like that you can like Valanciunas the third best at that in the league? And what does that say? But so it's being committed to running your offense and creating those opportunities, not just for the ball handler, but for the support player. And that's where the switching defense is really like lulling some of these teams into taking their third, fourth and fifth best offensive player out of the game by, you know, presenting Devin Booker with, oh, I can cook Reggie Jackson. Yeah, you might, but are you going to hit enough pull-ups to be worth not getting any corner threes for Mikal Bridges? And I think that's been the case. And I think a lot, you know, even the Bucks, you know, when they've kind of gotten burned a little bit by Atlanta in the series before the injury to Giannis, was them missing shots on offense almost caused them to panic about what was going on with their defense. Game one, they were up, was it 5 at half, when they had just substantially outplayed Atlanta, but they hadn't hit a jump shot. And so if they're up 12, like maybe they, you know, they quote should have been with the looks they were getting. Oh, Trey's got 20 some. Yeah, but this is working. He's hitting tough shots. No one else is doing anything. We're getting to the rim at will. We're up 12. Let's keep doing what we're doing. Instead, they're up 5. Atlanta hits a couple shots to start the second half. It's tied. Oh shit, we need to do something else. Just keep doing what you're doing and make shots, and it'll be, you know, it'll work out okay. So I as I ramble through this answer, I agree with the general point, while maybe disagreeing with the specific.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And a player that I also want to toss out there, and he gets left out of the conversation just because his defense is awful and his team's been awful, but I really have a soft spot for Karl Anthony Towns, and I think in a right situation, he could be an offensive counter to that sort of thing. So I'm hoping that he can wedge himself into this conversation.
No, that's a good call. I completely forgot about him. I thought, I honestly, here's how far out of sight, out of mind he was. I thought you were going to say Enes Kanter.
Well, to be fair, I mean, that was a bright spot for the 2020 Celtics when Kelly Olynyk was the five, perhaps the precursor to the Boogie mismatch on Dario Saric, if you ask me. No, don't ask me. Sorry, Cody, what were you going to say?
I think I was just going to jump in and say it's okay to have forgotten about Karl Anthony Towns and Minnesota. We could probably forget about them for the next couple of years, except for Anthony Edwards, who's a soft spot for all of us. But I digress. Let's get back to it.
Harsh.
Minnesota just caught some strays in the playoff pod. Oh, heavens.
Oh, my goodness.
Hey, Minnesota's probably pretty happy to be mentioned on a playoff pod, so.
Oh, no.
Oh, man.
That's so good.
For those in Minnesota, Cody lives in Minnesota. I'm not saying anymore, but.
I was going to say, I live
like get your man's.
15 minutes from the Target Center, so I feel perfectly equipped to be tearing them down right now.
Come have a spirited debate.
Okay, so I even forgot what we were talking about, but I guess that was my question, is like, and that kind of if you're going to like criticize Gobert in that series, it does make sense to do it on offense, and it kind of makes me realize that you really can't separate the two from a team building perspective, like at all. You know, in some ways, Trae Young could be better for your defense than like a decent like center, just because he allows you to focus on defense elsewhere. Okay, that was a weird example, but
I don't think so.
Yeah,
I think like if K, you have a, you know, a pick and roll player like Trae.
Yeah,
the fact that you can't dump the ball into Clint Capella in the post and expect something good to happen kind of doesn't matter. Because he can be an effective offensive player, because his ability to dive and finish is very well served by Trey's passing, by Trey's, you know, ability out of the pick and roll. So, yeah, Trey is perhaps the worst defender in the NBA, but if he lets you play Clint Capella 30 minutes a game, or 35, even more than that a game, and it not like negatively impact your offense, That is in some way helping your defense, I would say.
Hell yes.
I think Atlanta seems to be really instructive with this, because I was watching back at a couple of the Bucks-Hawks games, and I think Capella, I don't remember which game it was at this point, but I think his first couple of baskets he scored was on the fast break. So, you know, those are a couple of easy ways to score if you're going to be a flexible big like that. But then this kind of goes back to what I was saying about the complexity of NBA offenses, where in Game 7 against the 76ers, the Hawks ran this out-of-bounds play, and I'm not going to be able to describe it right off the top of my head, but ultimately Trae Young kind of just stood above the arc the entire time, and it ended with Capella just diving to the rim and it being completely clear for him to get a dunk. And all I could think in that was, and not to completely go back and be like, oh, point of attack defense is useless, but I was like, there wasn't any defender that could have just stood in front of this action that happened. This all happened because all the other players on the court for the Hawks were moving. They're all dangerous in different positions, and everyone else on the Sixers have to be really spatially aware of what they're going to be doing off ball. And so that was kind of a moment where I'm like, this is why it's really important to have really good secondary creators all over the court for offense, but also really spatially aware defenders on defense. And I almost think that's more important defensively than having a bunch of point of attack defenders, is having those guys that are aware of where everyone else is on defense so that they don't allow those kinds of wide open dives to the rim.
I mean, again, I'll push back and say, you know, if we're going to question execution, I give you the Philadelphia 76ers in the second half of basically any game in that series as an example of sort of not. And so again, I don't, you know, is it a roster thing, or is it a play better thing? Is it a pay attention and don't let the 7-foot guy just roll to the rim and dunk? You know, we can overcomplexify, that's not a word, the game somewhat, but in many cases, a lot of these breakdowns are pretty simple kind of first principle errors. And, you know, not I enjoy a complex theory as much as anybody, but sometimes you have to like, wait, no, hold on. Just make shots. Just don't let the guy get a free run to the basket. It's just, you know, not getting so far in like the derivatives of everything that's happening and almost simplify, I think is something we need. And I'm guilty of this as much as anyone is in terms of when you're starting figuring out what's going on. Okay, what's the first level analysis? What happened? And then it's like, oh, he got beat off the dribble. Okay. Was there something they did in a pick and roll to like create that, or did he just get beat? And then kind of start from there. And it's easy to forget to go back to that first thing, you know?
It's definitely something I think we're guilty of a lot, just being a like, or at least advertising, for lack of a better word, ourselves as like a philosophy-based podcast. So a lot of our first episodes were kind of just trying to drill down our ideals. And then we just started looking at, you know, different teams and different players and using that to explain our philosophies in a way. And I think as a result, you kind of smooth over some of these muddy aspects of basketball that you're wisely bringing up and saying, you know, not everything is going to prove you right or wrong in your philosophy, because it's just so much weirdness and so much going on.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, for lack of a better term, shit happens. And sometimes there's no broader reason than the way the ball bounced than the way it did. I don't want this to sound like I'm denigrating theorizing or anything like that, because goodness knows I do plenty of it. You know, I wrote a book with theory in the name. So it would be pretty churlish to say, no theories. But yeah, I don't know. Have I just come on your guys' podcast and completely crapped on you?
No, it's great.
I was actually just about to say, like, this is a podcast that I think we needed, because as a philosophy podcast, like, you have to do a lot of self-introspection into the theories that you're creating, right? And it you need pushback of that type, right? Like, sometimes I think it's important to sit down and be like, you know, what are we really seeing here? Like, are these larger trends, or, you know, is this just one-off stuff that just happens? And I think as a philosophy podcast, like, I think it's important to sometimes be in a position where you have to ask more questions than you can answer. And for me, that's what this playoffs has been, right? Like, I feel like sometimes I know less about ball after what's happened in these playoffs than what I thought I did before. And it's not necessarily as a result of the outcome of these playoffs. For me, it's more about how much can you take from a sample of this size, especially given what else is around it?
Yeah, and just acknowledging the natural bias you have to accumulate material for your philosophy-based podcast, right? So, all of a sudden, whereas, you know, instead of like maybe taking a second to like really think about, oh, what can I gain from this? Being like, oh, that's an angle. Hawks have more juice. They're going to beat the Bucks, or something like that. But I think what I was just going to zoom out for a second when I was talking about Gobert and how Trey can impact good defense. I think the one thing that Gobert might not do for a defense is he makes it so the Jazz have to or have been compelled to surround Donovan Mitchell with a lot of offensive minded players, in the sense that Donovan is getting better every month, it seems like, but it's not like, it doesn't seem like he's quite the Trae Young type who's going to immediately elevate a Capella type to play him and, you know, have a really, really good offense all the time. And so perhaps this is where, you know, the importance of surrounding him with offensive minded players comes into play. And that's why you get Bogdanović and Ingles. And as a result, it's very hard to find these guys who can do that and play really good point of attack defense. So that might be the one thing you could say about Gobert is, yes, he has to do it all himself, but he's part of the reason the Jazz have had to focus so much on offense around Mitchell.
Is this the part where we have the, is Donovan Mitchell really that dude conversation?
Oh,
because I'm here, but I am very here for that conversation.
Oh, so, yes.
So, I mean, I think you're asking that question in the kindest possible way. In that, you know, is like, you know, that's probably a broader topic that's better left on its own. But other than saying, yes, no, you're onto something. And if Donovan Mitchell was that dude, then we're not having this conversation. And especially if he was that dude, or he didn't revert to playing like he was in situations where the Jazz are stressed. I think that's again, you talk about your offense getting your defense beat. This is stuff I was saying while that series was going on, as there were some hero shots attempted early in games in that series, shall we say, and they went in early in games, and that sort of begat more hero shots. And we kind of saw how that played out over the course of successive games.
And it kind of all stems from Donovan Mitchell not quite being like a top tier primary creator, which Donovan Mitchell gets a lot of flack, but it is kind of funny to unpack the Jazz excuse Matryoshka doll.
Hold on. Does he? Like, again, there was one of the signature play. I'm going to hot take here. I know this is not a hot take, but the signature play of that series was the play where Paul George splits a pick and roll with Donovan Mitchell, doing a pretty blatant ole at him, kicks the ball to Terrence Mann in the corner, who drives middle and dunks on Gobert.
Yeah.
Not for the first time Donovan Mitchell got Rudy Gobert dunked on.
Yeah, no, totally. But just this Matryoshka doll, it's kind of like, oh, Gobert can't play on the floor. You take off that. Oh, it's because their point of attack defense isn't good. Oh, you take off that layer. Oh, it's because Gobert himself doesn't provide that much offense. So they have to surround Mitchell with offensive minded players who aren't Gobert. You take that off. Oh, it's because Mitchell isn't quite that dude. And so you need to put in Ingles. So that's kind of what my brain's doing right now. Yeah. I know I probably smoothed over a few steps right there. And I'd love to hear what those steps are if you'll indulge, no. But that's kind of where my brain is going.
No. So I think again, like, simplifying it down, you know what all that sounds like?
What's that?
They're just not good enough. Like, no, seriously, like, you know, like you're getting into some specifics of why, but it's like, again, it's, you don't necessarily have to tell a complicated story and, about it. It's just like, okay, yeah, you know, your third best player is, okay, I mean, if, okay, before they got Mike Conley, their third best player was Joe Ingles. Your third best player is Joe Ingles. I enjoy Joe Ingles greatly. If Joe Ingles is your third best player, unless your first two best players are LeBron and somebody, you're not good enough. So, and so the way they're not good enough kind of is expressed a certain way, but I don't know if the way they're not good enough necessarily tells a larger story about like an inherent weakness of a style in modern NBA basketball.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that like the some of us and I think fans are especially like people who tend to do this, like we want more teams to be relevant. So when teams aren't good enough, we try to think of a reason that they aren't. We try to diagnose why they aren't so that we can put a stamp on it that makes it sound fixable or seem fixable. To instill, you know, the goal of competition and parity. And sometimes there's just, and I'm not saying this about the Jazz, definitely not saying this about the Jazz, but sometimes the way the cards have been dealt and the positions that you found yourself in and the decisions you've made in the past stack up in a way that there's not an easy way out of the hole.
Yeah. And to go back to my slightly awkward, pinning it on the executives and management point about Gobert and the Bucks, I can say that, you know, they should have taken Gobert's regular season impact with a grain of salt, or they should have taken Giannis's MVP level season with a grain of salt. At the same time, if I was in that front office, what the fuck would I have done? Right. Oh yeah. If I was the GM of the Bucks,
now you're really asking me to get in trouble. So
the thing is, as it's easy for me to say, oh, I would have tried to get Damian Lillard to, you know, assuage those playoff half court creation woes. So really, it's like, oh, you know, why are the Jazz relying so much on Gobert for drop coverage? And why are they, you know, not getting better point of attack? It's like, what is their option, I guess, is another thing where everyone thinks they could do, you know, a small market team's job, where you can't get those guys necessarily better than the GMs. Right.
Well, I mean, you know, and then sliding door stuff. Well, if Gordon Hayward doesn't decide he wants to play in Boston, or if Dante Exum right. doesn't blow out his knee playing for right. Australia, or if was it Paul Pierce who tackled Alec Burks, you know, or if that doesn't happen and Burks develops into kind of the sort of the two-way creator that he looked like he might be becoming, like. You know, so all those things kind of stack up too. Just like the good and bad fortunes of like, yeah, Donovan Mitchell has massively outperformed his draft position, but that sort of only counteracts, like, you know, Dante Exum was the fourth pick, and that, I mean, we don't even know if that was a good pick or not, right? Just because he got hurt so much, so. How do you balance that over the lifespan of a team? Because, you know, that Exum being hurt kind of led to some other things, and you're giving Howell Neto actual money to be your backup point guard. And you know, Howell Neto's fine, but he's a third point guard who should get the minimum. But they give him actual money because they need to, because they can't count on. And you see how these things kind of stack up and stack up and stack up. And it's, you know, there's a lot of little things that add up to a team not being quite good enough that aren't just like, you dumbass, why didn't you, you know, pick this other player?
Yeah, no, it definitely, we needed this episode so badly. I'm just going back and thinking of all the conclusions we've drawn, and I'm just like, holy shit.
This is the inflection point though, right? Yeah. Like, I think what this teaches us is that, like, you know, it's important to pay attention in the short term and to draw conclusions and take that data into account, but you have to keep a long view because team building is a long view process. It takes a while, and it takes a while for bad things to be washed away by time, and it takes a while for good things to become, or good bets, good roster decisions to flourish, to show the proof that was in the pudding, I guess.
What would you have thought about Travis Schlenk's draft record a year ago?
I thought I actually was like, why does people like this guy so much? He hasn't found a secondary creator next to Trey. Everybody knows you can't just have Trey Ball, and that takes you far into the playoffs. That was my brain this time last year.
Yeah. No, I mean, the one guy I can say that I liked, you know, all the way through was Herter, but like, okay, you know, Collins and Hunter and
trading up for Hunter, you know,
yeah,
like,
yeah. And that seemed like, you know, that was valuing him more highly than most did. And yeah. And I like Okongwu looks like a real player, and, you know, so it's like, okay, maybe a year isn't enough time to judge a draft. As if we need to relearn that lesson again, just like we do every year.
Well, so what if I told you that maybe I feel a little bit more positive about Travis Schlenk's draft record in terms of who he chose, but I feel perhaps more negative about his asset management than I did before, just in the sense that I think it's taken, like, I want to be fair to the Hawks.
It's a lot of Danilo Gallinari. It's a lot of Danilo Gallinari.
Yeah, right. Like, I want to be fair to the Hawks because they've had a great run, and they're a team that's a lot of fun to watch. I think they have a really bright future, but it has taken an incredibly fortuitous run, I think, in a lot of ways for them to get as close as they're getting this year, and they may be in the finals. Like, winning a championship one time can do a lot to make your earlier decisions look good, but I think when we get to the point where the Hawks have to start paying these guys that they drafted, that they're getting solid playoff level production on rookie scale contracts, when they have to start paying these guys, I don't know if we're going to be as favorable about Schlenk's draft record, or at least how he managed the assets to draft the players he did. So I guess for me, that's, and I'm asking more questions than I'm answering, yeah, because we still have to find out what happens. But
yeah,
I guess, I mean, this is just another example where taking the long view is really important.
And yeah, you're talking about what realistically is good problem to have territory. Now you can go from there, and you know, I think there's plenty of recent examples of Eastern Conference teams that have gone from enviable positions to I don't really think you did that well with that. I mean,
I'm a Celtics fan, so yeah, I'm aware of that.
I was gonna say, yeah.
but you almost did many things, so
yeah. Like, that's on the goal line.
And you know that, and yeah, you know, Philadelphia is kind of the other obvious one. So yeah, I mean, and that happens, but you kind of, you know, you have to wait. You can't assume those mistakes are going to be made. Just, you have to wait and see. And then when they are, he's like, I knew you were going to do that, and then claim victory. This whole conversation reminds me of something Kevin Pelton, like, tells me all the time when I kind of get into like Twitter defense of whatever the pylon is, you know, today mode. And it's like, the thing you didn't do was always going to work. And that seems to be that's almost the implied attitude of, well, why didn't he blah, blah, blah? Well, because he many times is like, well, he thought about it. They looked at it on film. They practiced it and it sucked. So they didn't do it. But because they didn't do it and there's no counterfactual evidence, like, well, obviously it would have worked if you just blah, blah, blah. And it's very easy to play the counterfactual game when it's non-falsifiable that it would have been better than whatever you actually did.
Insert undersized five at the five would have won them the series. But that's just one of them. But I guess the one thing I'll say now that I'm thinking about it, about that I could maybe say about Travis Schlenk's draft record is, I wonder if this is the best possible version of that team, in the sense that, like, maybe Hunter, maybe Reddish, but I don't know if they have like a young guy in the chamber who's going to like break through and become like, and take them to that next level necessarily. So I do
Kevin
think
Kevin Herter is offended.
Yeah, you're right. Red Velvet, forgot about
him. I think Okongwu could be that guy too. I think he's exactly what the five position is starting to morph into. He was drafted as that. Atlanta, I will say, for Schlenk's draft record, like, Atlanta didn't galaxy brain themselves in this draft. They took the best player who was available at their slot, at least in terms of the college production, and somebody who fit their roster as well. And it worked out great for them so far. And I was high on Okongwu, so this confirms my priors. And that's why I will continue to be bullish about him.
Yeah, I agree with that. Okongwu has been just fantastic. There were a couple plays he made in the most recent game where I was just like, oh my God, this is a rookie out there in the Eastern Conference Finals doing this with Giannis. And yeah, that kid is extremely, has a lot of potential.
The play that sticks out is actually from game 4 when there's three guys in the league who can sort of not get knocked backwards by Giannis's, you know, straight down the center line Eurostep move. And I didn't know Okongwu was one of them, but I've never seen someone like stand, like not get knocked back by that. And while not getting knocked back, just yoink the ball. And he, you know, he, oh, okay. Like maybe, maybe Kawhi has done that once, you know, just like the strongest wing player in the league has done that once, but I've never like, I, and then that was like, oh, wow. That's
not a true seven footer. That's a 6 foot nine rookie. And yeah, like you mentioned, not only did he have the strength to stand there in the path, but the poise to think, to take the ball away. Like that's some pretty incredible stuff.
Okay. I may have forgot about Onyeka Okongwu, but, but I guess what I was trying to think is like, you know, I always wanted them to like, just take a shot on like, let's say, you know, I'm blanking, but like,
oh, cool. No.
Yeah. Or like someone, I don't know, just like any guy who could like be like a co-primary creator, which is, again, I've backed myself into this scenario where it's like, what would you have done, Scott? Oh, I would have simply picked the primary creator who was available when, you know, they picked DeAndre Hunter and said, oh wait, no, you can't play like Darius Garland and Trae Young together. Like, and so that's even like the best possible outcome. So I'm really
convinced
just,
more teams that LaMelo Ball was in the interview and then they pass on him.
Yeah, exactly. So really, I guess my strongest shot at Travis Schlenk is that he didn't draft players that didn't necessarily exist. That's all I got for you, Seth.
No, it's, and I have not been, this is a weird position to be in because I've not been a Trey guy and not been a Hawks guy. And so this is, you know, perhaps this is me overreacting to the enormous L I've been wearing about that. But yeah, like that, a lot of like things change pretty quickly. Like I'm in the process of revisiting the, like the player tiers I did last year for updating after the finals this year. And there are some from last year that are like, ooh, that does not look good anymore.
If it makes you feel better, Tyler Hero also made the premium hoops top 100.
I was just about to make a joke about him too. You know,
actually
beat me to that one.
That's not the Aaron Baines is the one.
Oh, okay. I still think like, Tyler Hero is going to be really good. That's just me though.
I mean, he was the victim of this year's hype beast cycle.
Right.
Where he got gassed up way too much over some pretty good games in the bubble last year, came back this year, was put in a role where, you know, they experimented because, you know, okay, him becoming like a you know, primary ball handler is a pretty big swing in kind of his usefulness. It didn't work out and he had some injuries and he shot the ball like crap and had a bad sophomore year. And now he's the worst player ever. And it's really just people like embarrassed for having like, you know, this is a multiple time all-star after he goes for a couple big games, you know, in the playoffs last year. Just like, you know, if you don't write those silly checks, then maybe you can be a little fair to the player when he doesn't live up to the expectations that you shouldn't have put on him anyway.
That's kind of been my thing with him is like, I'm just trying to be never too high, never too low about Tyler Hero. And that's pretty much like, when it comes to other players, I'll just be stupid and overreact, but that's been my guy. But Cody, were you going to say something? I'm sorry. I feel like I keep interrupting Cody for some reason and just no, all the time.
Just during that conversation, you were talking about overreacting and stuff. And I was just thinking like, should I jump in and say something about Drew Holiday? But I decided not to. So I'm not.
Oh yeah. Comment.
Do How it.
Dare you.
Exactly. We've got the right crowd here for this exact moment, Cody.
Well, Seth, earlier you were saying, and yeah, I'm always that kid in class that has a comment to make, but then never actually makes it and makes it like 30 minutes later. So I'm going to go way back to that because it's kind of relevant now. But Seth, you are the kindest disagreeer I've ever encountered in my life. And I appreciate that. So thank you for kindly disagreeing with things in such a kind way. I've said kind 4 times now in 2 sentences, whatever. But when you say at some point, you just have to stop analyzing and like look at how things are going. That's how I felt about Drew Holiday is I'm just like, I'm watching this dude brick shot after shot after shot. I live in Minnesota, but I'm a Bucks fan. And I started the season not super high on him. And then I got really excited about him during the regular season because he was killing it in minutes when he was on the court without Giannis and Middleton. And then in the playoffs, I have considerably dropped on him again. So he's my Tyler Hero at the moment.
I mean, did he make some shots for you in Game 7 against Brooklyn despite missing everything for the rest of that game? I mean, do those count too? You know.
Yeah, but also Eric Bledsoe didn't shoot 0% from the field. So, you know, I got to be
fair to him.
Can't
shoot 0% on zero shots. Ayo. No, just kidding.
Yeah. I don't know. I appreciate Jrue Holiday. I really do. There are some games that he's showed up and he's made some really timely shots, but I don't know. It just seems like teams have still been able to scheme by giving him just tons of space. And one of the key threes he made against Brooklyn in Game 7 was when they just gave him, I think I described it as Ben Simmons amount of space. And that's just because the Nets were like, all right, if you're going to beat us, Jrue Holiday is going to beat us. And look, they lost in overtime. So that proposition almost worked.
A big thing, and this is more of a general statement than specific to Jrue, but I think it applies to Jrue, is that the oftentimes players get blamed for sins elsewhere on the roster. So, like, Jrue Holiday being the second best playable shooter on the Bucks, is that a Jrue Holiday problem?
And also the second best perimeter creator on our, like, he's asked to do so much in terms of like perimeter creation as well, because otherwise the options are Giannis perimeter creation, which can work, but I think it's a little bit overdone. Chris Middleton ISO. So that another sins of the roster kind of example there.
Yeah. And again, like, you know, I think that there's, I think most people have been frustrated watching the Bucks most of the postseason, just in terms of the degree to which the potential and the reality, especially of their offense, hasn't really matched. And there's, I think that there is plenty of blame to go around for that, including to Jrue, but it shouldn't be just all focused on him. Like, you know, so I think that's, are they a better team with Holiday than they were with Bledsoe? I don't think it's on a playoff setting. I don't think it's close. I don't think it's arguable. And beyond that, you know, maybe you'd like it if Dante DiVincenzo being out didn't completely remove kind of that versatile wing player you needed from your roster.
Yeah, that's definitely all fair. And sorry I didn't respond before. I thought that was a rhetorical question. I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm supposed to jump in here. But so, I mean, there is also the counterfaction that is that almost happened, where if the Nets win, it's like, oh, so the Bucks lost in the second round last year. They made this huge trade where that was basically like a James Harden type trade, and then they lose again here in the second round. And I feel like even though we might be able to step back and take a more nuanced approach to that and be like, actually, no, let's look at these things that show why Jrue Holiday is better. It is a results league. Like, you do need to win at some point. And had that just been a second round exit, it would have been easy to point to that trade and be like, look at this abject failure that the Bucks just completed. But obviously that's not what happened. And we can have our more nuanced take while still hopefully seeing the Bucks keep being successful.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like you would have, like, how many years did the Raptors just get LeBron? It's like, oh, they did this, they did that. No, they just ran into LeBron in the playoffs, and what are you going to do? I mean, that would have been the big, like, again, the simplest story about that series, if Brooklyn wins it, is KD is the best player in the world, and he did the thing. And, you know, it might not be more complicated. It is definitely more complicated than that, but at the same time, it might not be more complicated than that. You know what I mean? I am a huge fan of kind of, again, simplifying things down as much as possible, because, again, you open yourself up to so many sort of cognitive cul-de-sacs when you add unnecessarily complexity and caveats and codicils.
I think something that bothers me a little bit is some of the critique around the Daryl Morey Rockets built around James Harden that essentially just ran into the Warriors a bunch of times. And like, I don't know how you build a, like, what do you tell that Rockets team? Don't miss 30 shots in the second half. Like, I think it raised some questions about heliocentrism, but I don't think there were wide sweeping conclusions to be made about losing to one of the greatest teams of all time multiple times. Like, the Rockets built a team that was able to compete with them if things went right, and things didn't go right.
So everyone's saying, hey, everyone else just like, don't, no, the Warriors have got this on lock. Everyone else just pack it in. And then the Rockets try and almost beat them. And it's like, ha ha ha, suckers. Like, what is that? Like, that's, you know, that is, I mean, that's purely people don't like James Harden is what it comes down to. People don't like James Harden, and a certain set of people don't like Daryl Morey because it's on some level, it's always going to be the nerds and the jocks fighting.
There's been a lot of extrapolating on the 27 missed threes. I'll just say that, you know, whether it's you need more juice to your ancillary players, you need to have them touch the ball more. I hear everything regarding that. And maybe if we're using the frame we've been applying, it's just basketball is really stupid sometimes.
This will shock you guys, by the way. Patrick Beverley just hit someone in the head.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I just, you know, I wanted to break news. And he clocked DeAndre Ayton pretty hard going for a block shot.
Anyway. Oh, my goodness.
And he disagrees vociferously with the call. That is your Patrick Beverley update.
Oh, jeez. Well, I hope Aiden's okay. Jeez.
But yeah, on that Rockets point, at some point you just have to like step back and be like, it's almost impossible that they missed 27 threes and lost that game. Like, there is no analysis beyond just being like, I don't mathematically know how this happened, but it did, and they lost because of it.
Simplest way to ask it. If you ask a GM, if you build this team, like, tell a GM, if you build this team, you're the only thing that can stop you from making the finals over the Golden State Warriors is 27 consecutive missed threes. Do you build the team? Yes, they build the team every single time. That's as simple as it gets for me.
Maybe, because it depends. Like, there are definitely teams that are built to minimize downside. And like in that team building context, you never build that team because you're trying to go complete like milquetoast chalk team building. And, you know, you can never really get, well, we needed this and we needed that. And then the player got hurt and he just wasn't as good, but you know, we did all the right things. And so that's a story you can tell, or you can not give a shit about the story you're going to tell. And it's like, no, let's just try to win. And, you know, I think you see this through all sports, basically. I don't want to make it sound like it's a binary, but it kind of is, where there's groups that are like, fuck it, let's go. And there are groups that are like, that might be embarrassing if it doesn't work. And, you know, I know which one I'd rather be. But that's not, you know, it's also that's one of those things that's easy to say when you know, your livelihood is not resting on it. But at the same time, like, why do it if you're not going to do it? So, but anyway, that's a whole other philosophical question.
Yeah, I was going to say this leads into a philosophical, probably a whole nother podcast about the merits and detractions from the American sports franchising model and the incentive for competition. But yeah, it's a whole nother podcast. So we'll leave it to a whole nother podcast.
Are you like, and the fact that it is not a pure competition because a team that gets knocked out of the playoffs doesn't actually go out of business, so they're insulated from the competitive pressures that are supposed to.
It's exactly what I'm getting at. And you're guaranteed a certain amount of profit share. Like the model is different when you look at the way teams try to compete to survive relegation in like overseas soccer leagues. That for me is
not that should be held up as the model for a healthy sports league. But yes, no, the incentives are different.
100% agree.
Yeah, and that could be a podcast down the road, but I think it's time to watch everyone's favorite part of an NBA game, the halftime show, which is how exactly this is synced up, because I believe it's now halftime of Suns versus Clippers. So Seth, you mentioned earlier that you had a book and that the name has the word theory in it. Would you be so kind to tell us any other words that are in the title?
The book is called The Mid-Range Theory. It is coming out from Triumph Books in November. I am in the process of doing kind of final copy edits. Well, you'll never understand your own verbal tics more than rereading your own writing at book length. I am pretty excited for it to come out. And I think it's, I've hopefully added some nice perspective on sort of how analytics has both affected and fit in with the development of kind of the modern NBA game, and how it's just one strand among, you know, many things, from skill development of players, the quote positional revolution, rule changes, strategy development, and how it all of those things kind of play together to give us the game that we have today.
All right. And Seth, you know, we'll leave little bits of that goodness in his articles on The Athletic. Co-host of The Athletic podcast, Nerder, She Wrote. Now, Evan and Cody have just utilized the Zoom chat in a way that Seth can also see, but they acted like he couldn't see. So I'm just going to read exactly what Cody said. Cody said to everyone, "Are we asking him about his bad takes?" And it took me a second, but yeah, Seth absolutely saw that. And then, anyway,
would you care to be more specific, or am I supposed to?
Oh, no, it's okay.
Am I supposed to engage in some, you know, self-critique? And like, the dumbest thing I ever thought was that Julian Wright was going to be really good.
All right. Well, that can't be yours.
There was a player type, like the versatile 6'8" wing who can't shoot has kind of been has been a weak spot of mine for a long time. But yeah.
Mine too.
Sounds like you worked for the mid-2010s Milwaukee Bucks there.
I did not work for the mid-2010s.
Okay, but yeah, so when we get to 48 reviews, we're currently at 40, Cody will espouse three of his worst takes. So it's just a custom on the podcast that we ask the guests to reveal any of their bad takes. For example, PD Webb just said that Italian is the worst food to get at a restaurant or something like that. So you can totally roll with the 6'8" wing take, or you can fire off another sweet one.
You got a food take that will make Mark Schindler's look good? I doubt it. That's pretty tough to do, impossible. But that's always an option. So
there's a hockey writer named Travis Yost, who I think that Mark and him should you know, come together, because they have the two most egregious food takes. Yeah.
You heard it here first. Mark Schindler, Travis Yost, Sixers Adam food take podcast fiesta. It'll be fantastic. We'll get working on
it. Yeah, I mean, it would be the podcast version of one of those like cooking videos where they make like gumball cheese fry surprise or something like that.
Yeah.
If you guys have seen it, I can't think of a better way to describe this than those TikTok videos where people are making various entrees, desserts, and appetizers in the bowl of their toilet. That exists. You can find this. It's out there. It's relatively popular. I don't go on TikTok, and I've seen them, so it's a thing that exists. Yes, Mark,
I know what you're
those are your
about.
Food takes, my friend. I apologize.
It's the worst thing ever. It's the worst.
You've seen it without going on TikTok?
Yep.
That means I am not safe. Oh, fuck. All right. Well, I'll just try to avoid those videos and keep glued to the second half and not check my phone, because I don't want to see that. All right, folks. Thank you for listening again. Seth, thank you so much for coming on. Be sure to listen to Nerder, She Wrote, as well as keep up. Honestly, they're giving away athletic subscriptions like candy nowadays. I get the $1 per month offers on, not that it's not worth the usual $7.99, but if you see that $1, they're doing a bunch of promotions. So you really have, if you have a buck, you have no excuse to not read Seth's great work on The Athletic. Look out for The Mid-Range Theory next year. Thanks again, Seth.